Now, I'm looking on my Zoom screen. We were talking about doing this in person, but we're not. We're on Zoom, and that is fine and dandy with me. I'm looking at Joanne Clarkson, which is not the first time I've done this in my life, but it's just the second. And Sheila Bender, I've been in a room with Sheila Bender before, back in the pre-COVID days. They are two writers. They are both poets, not exclusively poets in the case of Sheila Bender, but mostly poets. And poetry is primarily what we're talking about. They have two books, one apiece, two recent books which touch on coping with grief through writing, whether poetry or prose. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you. I'm really, really happy to be doing this and to see you.
Yes, and you know, this is kind of turning things around. I'll explain that in a minute, because Sheila used to host a show, but we'll talk about that in a second. And Joanne, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sheila's latest book is Since Then, and Joanne's is Hospice House, from which they will be reading tonight. Both Joanne and Sheila have published numerous other works, have taught workshops, have active online presences, so you can look them up and learn a lot about them. For 5 years, Sheila hosted In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life, one of the finest shows KPTZ ever aired. This conversation, however, begins with an email from Sheila to me, and this is what she said, in part, but she said, "I hope this conversation, idea, on how poetry and all writing can help us through difficult times appeals to you. I could speak on how writing helps to connect the feelings we have in sorrow and to living memories of those who are no longer here. After loss, we can resolve to value our lives even more fully, to live each day both for ourselves and for the ones who have died and for those who are still living, which brings us to treasure the moments of our days. Writing gets us there." Sheila's a writer. She wrote those words. And Sheila, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I'm grateful that you enjoyed those words and thought that the conversation would be worthwhile. And I'm really happy that I was able to invite Joanne to join us. Her work is beautiful and very much simpatico. Our work, it's different, but it's very simpatico. And I think by the time we're done this evening, people will be invigorated about how writing can help and about how they can feel the hardest things there are to feel.
And you know of those things. I guess to begin, a question for each of you. We'll start with Joanne, since Sheila just spoke. Tell me how you came to know grief in a very personal way.
Well, death kind of informed my childhood. My sister had died before I was born. She was always a presence in our lives. And then when I was 9 years old, my father developed pancreatic cancer and then died when I was 10. Any death is traumatic. This was a very public death. Both my parents were very active in the community. My mother and I became the family that had this tremendous death. And I've written several times about how I felt that. It made me different. I became much shyer and more reserved after that experience, I think, just because I was seen as different. Death is scary to people. And then 2 years after that, my beloved grandfather, my grandparents lived right by us, and I saw them every day, was in a horrific car accident. And he survived for 2 years, but it was a terrible 2 years. And so it seems like my whole childhood was about people dying. And so it kind of, in a way, it familiarized me with the feelings of grief and fear and all sorts of things that I continue to write about to this day.
And then you chose a line of work, which very much touches upon.
Actually, we'd been in hospital so much. When I graduated from high school, I went to college on a nursing scholarship. And I did well with my studies, but when I got to the floor, I couldn't do it. I cried every single day. Everybody was my dad, my sister, my grandpa. And so I quit nursing, ended up with a degree in library science, and did that for 20 some years. But after I took care of my mom then through a long illness until her death, when that was completed, I told my husband that all my life, I felt that my true calling was to be a nurse. So I was almost 50 years old, but I quit my job and went to nursing school and became a nurse. And for about the next 15 years, I did home health and hospice. And I felt that it was my true calling.
A couple of comments. One is, I can tell that you have a cat because I'm seeing something in the background behind you. So thank you for having a cat, and of course on Cats in Our Laps.
Actually, Alice was a hospice cat. Her owner died I did this many times as a hospice nurse. We had pets that were orphaned by loss. And I went around begging anyone, please take this animal. I don't want to take him to the shelter. And so when I heard this lady had died and they simply could not place the cat, although we already had other cats and this was not the greatest time, I couldn't say no to Alice. So we have our, and our other cat has since passed away. So we have our Miss Alice, and she's a very good cat.
Lucky Alice, indeed. Sheila Bender, your connection to grief.
Well, unlike Joanne, I had very few losses as a child. I mean, eventually when I was in college, my grandparents died one after the other. Maybe it was my age. Maybe it was my preoccupation with school and my young life. It didn't hit me as tragic. Of course, they were elderly. I was far away. So now, you know, I would revisit that and maybe think that I also was just inexperienced with grief. But about 22 years ago, when my son was 25, he died in a snowboarding accident at Breckenridge. And that was, I have to say, it was two things. It was the shock of my lifetime to find this out, to be called. He was flown to a Denver hospital. I was here in Port Townsend writing. I was at the time living in Seattle, but coming here to write, and was beside myself, as you can imagine, trying to get to the hospital, and did get there the very next morning. But they had determined that no blood had gone to his head for, you know, over 24 hours, and he was brain dead, and we had the choice to take him off life support. By that time, his dad and his stepdad, my husband, Kurt, and my daughter and her new husband, and his fiance and their family, they had all been skiing together. We were all gathered there. So it was a very shocking, numbing time. And my first response to it, besides all the things you do, there's a lot of writing associated with someone dying. There's obituaries, there's services, there's all kinds of things, telling people. But after that, I just sort of thought, okay, I've got to give up my best thing. My best thing was writing, because my son is my best thing and he's not here. And when you are grieving, all kinds of thinking that might not be considered rational comes to you. It wasn't that long before I thought, no, in order to live in his memory, I have to live with my best thing to honor him. And so that was a big pivot to writing.
And what I want each of you to do now, starting with Sheila, is to write one of your earliest poems on the matter of grieving and explain how it helped you.
Okay. During the first month, maybe the first two, maybe three, time is kind of a blur from back then, I found that wherever I went, nobody heard me. Like if I was at a deli case, they'd say, can you, what do you want? Wherever I was not speaking up. And I remembered a poem in a book I had been teaching from. The book is by Edward Hirsch, a poet, and it's called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. And one of the poems he had in the book in translation was a poem called The Voice of Robert Desnos, who is the poet. And he calls to all kinds of things because his love is unrequited. So I thought, okay, I'll copy this. I'll try. So I wrote a poem I call to the ski slopes of Breckenridge, after Robert Desnos. I call to the ski slopes of Breckenridge. I call to the trees on the slopes of Breckenridge. I call to the snow and the ice hanging in their branches. I call to the snow on the run and the melted layer of that snow iced over. I call to my son and his thermal clothing, to my son, 25 years old and snowboarding, headed into the trees. I call to my son to tumble off the board and never reach the trees. I call to my son not to worry about looking clumsy, not to worry about finishing his run. I call to him and I call. The ski lift stops with its human cargo, quiet and still, and the trees begin to lean, but they are slow, and the snow and the ice on their boughs fall in clumps to the ground, batter on a spoon I cannot see. My son does not hear me, but I call over the weeks between then and now to the hospital in time of death, 3:30, December 28th, 2000, and he does not tumble where I want him to. I call, clear as the moon, single eye I howl beneath, a coyote licking pebbles from a wound. I call and I call. The wound weeps holy water over my eyelids, hands, knees, feet that will carry me the rest of my days. In the snow, I see my sadness crystallize, hear my voice force follicles in my body to burst along their single seams, spread seeds, seeds I see in sunlight, and my son, everywhere, everywhere I call. Oh, it changed me. I got my voice back, is one way. And the other way is I see that I've come to terms with the fact that I cannot change this. And yet I can see him everywhere. I think it's very hard to paraphrase a poem, but it both separated me from his moment and brought me closer to him.
And how long after his death was it that you wrote that?
I think in the first couple months when I realized I wasn't going to give up my best thing.
Joanne, what we were wanting you to do next was to read one of your earliest poems about grief.
Of course, since I was just a little girl, I didn't immediately write a lot of poems. Although I did write poems when I was young, I didn't write about my father till I was older. And strangely, I've still never written exactly about his death. I've written more about the effects on us. Although I finished this poem a few years ago, it's one I've written drafts of for years. Holyrood is where he's buried. It's a Catholic cemetery in North Seattle. This poem is called Holyrood. Relic of the True Cross. At the cemetery's entrance, bare wood crossed bare wood without a body. When I touched it in dreams, my hands woke stinging, the way after a day playing in the forest, my mother took a needle and gouged out splinters. I have no idea how she paid for that plot where we buried my father. His income had been simple, like the hammer on his headstone. She, who was just my mother, must have sold something, perhaps something from her mother. My job was to find the public spigot and fill the metal cylinder that fit into his marker with water so cold it wept inside out. In summer, we brought iris, in winter, evergreen, our skin stained with pitch, the scent of what we cut. Shivering there, a woman and her 10-year-old, we never prayed. Listened instead to the tomb of wind called missing. She bent and with bare fingers brushed away grass clippings, gently, the way she washed his body and my hands.
And Joanne, when was that written?
I've probably finished it 10 years ago, maybe, but like I said, I've had drafts of that poem for a long time.
When did you begin to be a poet?
Everyone in my family was very, very artistic. My mother was a brilliant musician. She played the piano and other things. She could hear any song once, from a symphony to something on the radio, and sit down and play it. She would sit and play for hours and hours. And my cousins were all graphic artists of one kind or another, and I had no musical talent, and I couldn't draw. But I can remember distinctly one day we were riding in the car, and it was sunset, and Mount Rainier was this beautiful pink color. And my mother went home and wrote a song about Mount Rainier. And Patsy went home and painted a picture of Mount Rainier. And I wrote a poem. And ever since that day, I knew that writing was my way to express beauty, the beauty that I saw around me.
And how does reading and writing that poem, how does that serve your need for solace?
A memory of the feeling, I guess. And the main feeling of myself when I was young, and even to this day a little bit with my father, is sort of emptiness. And I guess writing about him, which I've done a little bit more recently, has kind of repainted him for me.
Bringing him back.
Yeah, because he's been over 60. He died in 1960. That's over 60 years ago. That's a long time.
I should try to bring my parents back that way. I am not a poet, though maybe I have it in me to be. Sheila, your first book after Seth's death is A New Theology. In the context of this conversation, contrast the therapeutic values of prose and poetry. I say that because the book, A New Theology, is largely prose. There is poetry in it, of course. Do they both serve in the same way, prose and poetry?
Well, Yes and no. Yes, yes, yes. Because all writing, if it evokes experience, whether it's a poem or whether it's prose, comes through our senses to our hearts. So it can happen in prose, it can happen in poetry. But I think if I had to pin it down in the way I think your question wants me to, I would say that prose is about story and poetry is about moments. So it isn't like the story doesn't have poetic language at times, and it isn't like the poems don't have some narrative. But the thing that compels the person to speak is different. I think the poems are about the poet feels a moment and wants to write that moment. And the prose writer has a story to tell, including me. I mean, I needed to write that book, A New Theology, to find out how I would go on without my son, to find out how I would face the date 5 months from when he died that he would have gotten married, how I would face my own mortality, because losing him spun everything in a new direction. And I suddenly had to really think about something that I think most of us put off thinking about. I certainly did. I hope that's enough of an answer. Story versus moments.
That's a good answer, concise, and I appreciate it. Joanne, any comments on your part?
Yeah, I have actually written a prose collection also called There's Always a Miracle. When I retired from nursing in 2016, I just felt compelled not to lose the stories, because it really is a miracle. I, as a hospice nurse, witnessed what can only be described as miracles when people crossed over and what happened to them and their loved ones. And so I wrote out some of the miracles so as not to forget. And I agree with Sheila. The prose is, I like poetry better. This was a lot harder for me to write, just setting it down so people can understand the narrative. And my heart soars when I write a poem. I kind of enter another dimension. And there's a quality of imagination there. Not that these stories aren't imaginative or hopefully interesting to read, but poetry is different. There's a different quality. And for me, it's more fulfilling to write poetry.
Sheila, I'd like you to read A New Theology, the poem, not the whole book, of course. And we'll follow it with a song, Roseanne Cash. And you're going to tell us why the song, and you're going to read the poem beforehand, though.
The memoir is called A New Theology, Turning to Poetry in a Time of Grief. But in order to explain turning to poetry, of course, I'm writing the story of grief. But this is the, I guess we would call it the title poem, because it's the poem that carries the title of the book. A New Theology for Seth Bender, 1975 to 2000. Who has no likeness of a body and has no body is my son, now 5 months dead. But in my dreams, he brings the peace in gardens. And I see him in his smile, and he is hearty in the rolled up sleeves of his new shirt, well fed, when he has no likeness of a body and has no body. I see him next to me in conversation at a party, and I believe that he is fine, because this is what he said. Because in my dreams, I sit with him in gardens. The nights he comes, the cats moan long and sorry. I believe they see his spirit entering my head, he who has no likeness of a body and has no body. In my life, accepting death comes slowly, but the midwifery of sadness and of shock bleeds after birth, dreams that bring the peace in gardens. I know that he is far, and he is here, and he is holy. Under sun, I feel the energy it takes to come away from God, who has no likeness of a body and has no body, who is in my dreams, the dreams that bring me gardens. This poem is a villanelle. That's why there's so many repeated lines. It follows that form. I had been learning from the book I was teaching from, the Edward Hirsch book, How to Read a Poem, that the villanelle is especially good for retrieving loss. But whenever you do one thing in poetry, you're also doing its opposite. So I'm retrieving the loss and I'm gaining my son. And it is based on a dream I actually had, in which he returned and he did tell me he was fine and he did look fine. And I think that's a common occurrence for people who have lost someone they love. A visitation comes. And so I use the villanelle form to do that. Shall I talk about the music?
Why don't I talk about the form? I really appreciated the fact that the poem that was taken from or based upon had form. and the fact that yours does as well. And I came to realize how much I appreciate form in poetry, and in fact, don't seem to encounter it anywhere near so often as I would like.
I might as well say the one you're talking to was that I used as my model is called One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. And it's a really famous poem about loss, Villanelle. And I needed that poem right next to me, right to the left of me, to follow the pattern. I mean, I'm not using her words at all. It was hard for me to keep the form in my mind. And I don't know if that's why we don't come across form so much anymore, but it's a challenge. But the parameters for the poet help, I think, help us come up with more than we might have without those parameters.
And to the song, Sheila, to the song.
In the back of my book, I've listed things that meant a lot to me in the months right after my son died. And September, when it comes, I don't remember how it came to my attention. I think that it's a song that actually in it, the poet is thinking about dying herself and flying to heaven where a beloved child is. But for me, the words and the tune, which we'll hear soon, just synced up with what it feels like to, like Joanne said, you're a different person than everybody else when this happens to you. The weird thing is, though, it's going to happen to all of us. All of us will experience grief. So we're all alike in that way. And yet we feel at the moment of our grieving that the world is going on without us, and that's just fine. So when there's lyrics in here, I cannot move a mountain now. I can no longer run. I cannot be who I was then. In a way, I never was. Just sang to me. Of course, there's a mountain. My son died on a mountain, but I couldn't move that mountain even with my words. But you can't run from who you are. You can't run from your essence. And sometimes your actual essence becomes clear in grief. That's why.
Okay, we'll play the song. And after we play the song, we'll turn to Joanne. What I'll ask for Joanne is a poem that comes to her mind in response to both the song and especially to Sheila's poem. So September When It Comes.
There's a cross above the baby's bed, a savior in her dreams. But she was not delivered then, and the baby became me. But there's a light inside a darkened room, a footstep on the stair, a door that I forever close to leave those memories there. So when the shadows lengthen to an evening sun, well, first there's summer, then I'll let you in September when it comes. To crawl outside these walls, close my eyes and see, and fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now. I can no longer run. I cannot be who I was in a way I never was. I watch the clouds go sailing. I watch the clock and sun. Oh, I watch myself depending on September. when it comes.
Was a magnificent song by Roseanne Cash, and thanks to Sheila Bender for recommending it. Sheila Bender and Joanne Clarkson are my guests in this part of Cats in Our Laps. Both of them are poets. Both of them have a new book, Since Then, for Sheila, Hospice House for Joanne. Joanne, I asked you to read one of your poems that comes to mind based on what you heard from Sheila just then.
I had a couple that I was thinking about reading, and I think I'm going to do this one. We were talking about dreaming and whatnot. About a year and a half ago, I had a friend who was a hypnotist who told me he could hypnotize me back to any place, any time, and I could experience perhaps someone that had crossed over or something like that. And I meditate and whatnot, and I feel like I've experienced people who have died. But I had never done my father. It was very scary for me to do this because I wasn't sure what would happen. But I said, okay, I'll go through this. And the meditation went through, and then they took me to a garden, and there was supposed to be somebody sitting on a bench, and I would see them, and supposedly it was going to be my father. And the amazing thing was that it didn't happen at all like I thought it would happen. And so I wrote out the experience in my journal, but then I turned it into a poem, and it's called Seance for My Father. She is always with him in every dream, sitting obediently in adoration, the white tip of her black tail alert as a small, vigilant flame. A shelter pup he brought home for me when I was young enough to know the animal alive in all of us. Excitable and soft. He never taught her voice commands or hand signals. The tenderness between them brought her home, walked beside him, drank from a silver bowl. The years after his death, she lived like a ghost next to the homecoming door, where I waited each day at 6 o'clock, scent of supper in the hopeful evening air. Now that I am so much older than he ever thought to be, in dreams so deep, everything is believed. I see her first, frisky mongrel rescued from a cage, and then the shadow of his firm, gentle hand caressing her fur, brushing tender against my skin.
I'm wanting to thank both of you, actually. Sheila, in particular, I was not aware of you at all, Joanne. But now, just how it was, I don't follow poets and poetry so much as I guess I would like to. But your book, Hospice House, which I read cover to cover twice, I found very moving. A question for both of you, and by the way, I did send you notes. I didn't provide the disclaimer that is, yeah, I sent you notes, but will I follow those notes? And as Sheila would certainly know, probably not. So here we go, diverging, maybe not so much. From your standpoint as writers, we'll start with Joanne here. I can understand how the exercise, the work of writing poetry in these cases, would take you to and away from your grief. The reading that I did to prepare for this, on the other hand, made me face an aspect of reality that, quite frankly, I try to not think about very much. it's not to say that I shouldn't. You know, I'm 3 days away from my 76th birthday, so I should probably be thinking about it more than I am. But contrast the value. I use the word therapeutic. Maybe you don't like it. Maybe I'm not sure I like it either. Fine. But contrast the value to the writer, to the value, and perhaps even the threat to the reader. And we'll start with Joanne. And no, that was not on your list.
No, that's all right. Actually, my last book came out, The Fates, came out in 2017. It won a contest back east. The Fates has some of my poems about my father and my early life, but it was a little different. And so since 2017, I've accumulated a bunch of poems that have been published and that I've written, and it was time for a new book. And so I put together a couple of manuscripts, and they just weren't clicking. And I have a very close friend I call my poetry sister named Linda, back at Olympia, where we moved from. And she said, Joanne, why don't you just write about hospice? And I said, because I don't think people want to read about dead people. It's sad. And she said, yes, but it's what you love and what you write about. And it's your book. And through you, people are going to come to, she says, when I read your poems, I'm not particularly sad. It's something everyone goes through, but it's almost a transcendent experience. Of course, there's all sorts of different kinds of grief. We have Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief. I write to honor the dead. I write to honor the people who survived them and who cared for them. And to me, for the last 10 years at least, that's simply what I write about. And I really can't write as eloquently about anything else. So yeah, it's a tough thing to read, in some sense, a tough thing to write, but maybe it's my purpose in writing to do this.
So, Joanne, why don't you read that other poem that you were going to read? You chose the one that you did read, and then we'll turn to Sheila with the same question.
My mother had cancer twice, survived it, and then got a disease called scleroderma, which is kind of like MS, not a fun thing to have. She died rather suddenly. She went into renal failure, and we had about 1 day with her before she crossed over. And she lived through the night, and in the morning, my kids and Jim and everyone else that had been there left, and I was alone with my mother. And I had probably the most profound experience of my life. And that's when I had the courage to quit being a librarian and going back to nursing school. This is a synopsis of that experience, and it's called Vigil. All of them were there outside the window. Grandmother, lost daughter, the farmhouse neighbors, weather of darkness and shine, all her longing and regret in a single final breath. The miracle was that I saw them too, not features, but form, recognition born in the slope of a shoulder, the cant of a hand, horizon of shadows like the familiar Olympic range or the magnified edge of a tattered wing. Yes, I knew them all by flesh or legend. And as her body fell still, I heard in my head the voices asking if I, the newly orphaned daughter, wanted to cross over too, as if through softened glass into some boundaryless love. Did I? Did my reciprocal love pass through even for an instant? But I am mother, wife, and neighbor, and must fulfill my years, gathering the shadows that will guide me through the glass.
Sheila, do you remember the question?
For me, and I think I told you this in one of my notes to you, I believe that what people in grief need is a certain kind of conversation, the conversation that most of us don't have daily. And in poetry, especially, but in certain prose about loss as well, music, we can find that conversation. And I think poets are fearless in the way that they're going to go with the poem. The words are going to take them places they don't expect when they start. My poetry teachers would say, the words are smarter than we are. The words are wise. You have to learn to listen to your words and go where they're taking you. So we do it. And sometimes we cry when we do it, but I'm going to bet most often we don't. We're in some sort of flow and we're just there. It's not like channeling in a way. We're just there with our words. And when we're done and we read them is when the tears can come. And sometimes when you read them to other people, it just is sort of funny, but I've been mailing a lot of the new book out to members of my website, writingitreal.com, where I'm partly advertising it, although it's in all the usual places as well. But I get to sign them that way, and I get to send them out. And I get to the post office, and she says the question she has to ask, is there anything dangerous in your package? And I say, of course there is. It's a book of poems. And they are dangerous, and that's why people are afraid of writing poetry. People are afraid they don't understand poetry. My belief is they understand it. If it hasn't been ruined by a teacher somewhere along the line, they understand it, they feel it, just like you felt the one art model that I used for a new theology. We feel it, but we don't have words for those feelings, and that's okay. The poet is giving us words. So what I think is, not every poem is for every reader, but I know that my hope for my book is that it goes out to the people who need the conversation and don't have it necessarily as deeply as they need it and can find it and not feel so different, like we've been saying, and feel like there is a way. And then I just want to quote the poet Marilyn Chen, who wrote a very distressing poem about a mother who's just given birth in China to a girl and knows that her husband is taking this girl to kill her because it's not a boy. And people have asked her, how can you write this? How can you write this? And she said, the thing that she leans on is language, that no matter what we're doing as poets, there's a pleasure in finding the words and in hearing the music of the words and in connecting with the human spirit in its dark and in its light. So I hope that answers a little bit about, at least from inside, what it feels like. And then I do think that the poems touch people, perhaps painfully, but hopefully restoratively. Because I think every poem, as another poet in close by, Bill Mawhinney, who used to lead the Northwind reading series, says, poems always say yes. They always say yes. And they do, even when there's something so sad. That's my answer.
Sheila, from since then, do you have a poem bookmark that you can pick up and read right now?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. I was very influenced by an article I read in the Sun magazine when I was in deep grief. And it was an article, an interview with Martin Prechtel, a shaman. And he says in that article, in that interview, grief is an obligation to the life one has been awarded, an obligation to life to make more life. That to me is one of the most encouraging things you can read when you're grieving. So Here it is. Bereaved, I turn to gardening. Before I can eat, I must prepare. Before I prepare, I must harvest. Before I harvest, I must plant. Before I plant, I must enrich soil with minerals contributed by other plants, plants I leave there so their roots make nitrogen for seeds to plant again, watered, given space, harvested not too early, not too late. And I keep these seeds, at least some of them, protected from the hungry squirrels of attachment, away from mold that forms on memories. I eat what I have grown, what I harvest, and what I chop, what I cook to break down so I can metabolize this world and feed yours, my deceased and beloved son.
And we are co-gardeners, and I especially attached myself to that poem, actually. When I sent you the notes that I sent you, I said, this is way too much. I'm looking at the clock, and I was right about that. So I have to decide where I want to go. I think what I would like to do is ask Joanne whether you read your poems to your, well, I guess you're retired. So let's put this in the past tense, whether you ever read your poems to your patients and how they responded.
Yes, and actually I still write them to people who have losses. I'm still in touch with some of those families that I served a long time ago. And as we keep talking about, it's important to be seen and to witness and to know what they've gone through. And as we know, grief doesn't go away, whether it's 60 some years ago or 10 years ago or yesterday. But I want to read one because we moved here in 2018. And I was kind of aware a lady down the block's husband had had a stroke and she was caring for him, which is very hard. He passed away two summers ago. Just this past summer, I was walking up to the mailbox and I noticed she had planted the most beautiful geraniums in her planter boxes outside her house. I came home and I wrote this poem just from the little I knew about her, and I gave it to her. And of course she cried and cried and I cried and cried. It's very hard not to, but she said, "You saw me. You hardly knew me and you still saw me." She said, "You don't know how many people have avoided me since Brian's death because they can't bear to talk about grief or to see their own griefs." So I'm going to read Mardella's poem called Phases of Mourning. "You changed his sheets 1,000 times those final months. So tired, time became only phases of night. That he was grateful, you took for granted, since slurred words ran like soup from the left side of his listless mouth. And then the dying, another term for absence. He took your stature, your talent, your humors, all colors of them. What does it take to awaken? Pain, certainly, but also the rejection of your own dance with death. You plant geraniums on the porch, then walk bareheaded to the mailbox. You change the sheets for your dreams only. You learn to live within them."
That's Joanne Clarkson. Sheila Bender, you wrote A New Theology, I think it was 2007 it was published, and since then came out, I guess it's coming out right now. It's coming out, Party is just about right
it
now.
It came out in June of 2022.
So almost this year. I would like you to contrast the books and contrast yourself between the writing of those two books.
Okay. I will. And then I have a special request. Today is my mother's birthday. She died 2 years ago. She would have been 96. I would love to read a poem that I wrote for her, which is in keeping with the mourning. But that goes with this conversation. So the first book was really hard to write. It actually took me 7 years. But most of the work in it was written very early in the first, say, 3 or 4 years of this. And I was writing it because that's what I do, because that's what I realized I had to do was my best thing, as I said earlier, because my son was my best thing and I didn't have him anymore. So I began going back to my writing group and just bringing what I had, which were these essays. Like you, Phil, I had the question, why would anyone want to read these sad essays? And they did. And not only that, they started asking me if they could share them with other people. And of course, I said yes. And then eventually one of them said, "You know, you really have a book here." So I knitted them together and added things in, and it was a process. And the book came, and the book was really important. It changed me. That book changed me. It changed my ability to live without him. It changed my grief. It changed my understanding of mortality. And it gave me a new life, just coming to grips with all of that. So since then is kind of since that book, you know, since then. And so it's a journey still with the idea that grief comes back. It comes back. It's never finished. It appears again and again, but it has a different quality over the years. I think that since then has helped me feel that. I have two grandchildren since then, and now they're since the first book, and they're really quite old now. One is 17 and one is 20. But I have a new death. You know, my mom isn't gone that long, and I really think about her a lot. So I wonder if I could read that poem for her.
Of course. Tonight.
Thank you. It's called Say Summer for My Mother. The whole poem is from a title of a poem by Stanley Plumley, who was one of my teachers. And it's a short lyric poem. It's quite beautiful. You can find it online. Say Summer for My Mother. It's all about summer, I think. But I couldn't just stick with that. So I say, if I could, I would give you back all the seasons of your life. How from a New York garment industry family, you loved purchasing handsome clothes for my father, clothes to fit your small budget, always expensive looking, to bolster his career. I'd give you a recording the two of you made in Times Square, vowing to marry. Though underage, he joined the Navy and shipped out to Oklahoma after his grandfather signed for him so he could escape a restrictive household. I'd give you back your elopement when at 18, he lined up a judge, bought a ring, rented an apartment for the two of you after your parents finally allowed you to take the train to visit. I'd give you back the weekdays when I had morning first grade and you took me to the cinema while my sister was in afternoon kindergarten, the weddings and bar mitzvahs you took me to as your plus one while Dad stayed home with her. I don't know if I would give you back the days before I left for college. You wanted to shop for my college wardrobe, as you called it, and I wanted to spend time with my friends and boyfriend before we all left for different corners of the country. I wanted to wear desert boots, jeans, and sweatshirts, abhorrent to your sense of fashion. But I would give you back the dress you sent me to wear to my sister's wedding after my second baby, the blue cotton suit and pink shirt you bought for that toddler who fell asleep at dinner, his face practically in his soup. I would give you back the day you sat in a lawn chair outside our new split-level home and watched me walk toward you down our block. It was fall with a brisk breeze in the air, rouging my cheeks, and you asked if I knew how pretty I was. It struck me that it was new for you to say this. In the week before you died, your caregiver told me you were sorry you had given me such a hard time. He nodded when I ventured, you must have meant when I divorced 40 years before. And the day you asked where my father was, and I inhaled to answer, but you remembered, he's dead, isn't he? I held my tongue, not to say it had been true for 20 years. In my silence, you told me three things. I love you. I love being with you. I will miss you. I don't need to give you those sentences back. I cry whenever I say them.
I was wondering, both of you, when you write, you must sometimes see spots of moisture on your paper. Maybe you're writing on your computer keyboard, in which case you have to worry about drowning out the keyboard and having everything short circuit. It must be tough writing sometimes. Joanne, you go first.
Yes, but it's a wonderful catharsis. You need to cry. A lot of times right after a death, you don't cry. It's just too much to take in almost. And having that letting go, letting your emotions flow is beautiful. One thing you said when you sent us, you wanted something we wrote recently, and talking about giving poems to people and thinking about people. When I became a hospice nurse, I started at Harbors Home Health and Hospice, and a nurse named Sherry trained me. And Sherry is the kindest person I ever met in my life and a great mentor. And she crossed over recently. This is a brand new poem. And so I wanted to read a brand new poem to honor my beloved friend. And it has to do with hospice patients. And it's called The Softest Cloth for Sherry. The day I shadowed you learning home hospice nursing, you warned me on the drive to his cabin about the patient dying of throat cancer whose disease progressed upwards, disfiguring his speech and features. His door was unlocked. You entered like a friend, laid out supplies as if for a morning shave. His eyes spoke what his lips could not. He loved you for seeing more than a wound. I waited at the corner of his vision, handing you the irrigation solution, powders to ease odor, a roll of the softest packing cloth. You chatted about weather, praised the beauty of his woodland acre, then scaled pain no number could ever describe, increasing dosages meant for dreaming. As goodbye, you smoothed sheets over bones, then gently touched his forehead, your fingers tracing shadows of all a face can mean.
Joanne, one more question for you. How do people find you? How do people find your books to buy your books?
And I have a website, joanneclarkson.com, and then I have them down at Imprint Bookstore and Phoenix Rising as well. They can be ordered on Amazon or through Barnes & Noble. But my email is joanneclarkson28@gmail.com. I like it when people order them directly from me, because then I can write an inspiring personal message.
Well, if people would like to do that and did not hear what Joanne said about her email address, an easier one than Joanne's is cats, C-A-T-S at kptz.org, and I will send you on to Joanne. Thank you very much, Joanne, for being with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's wonderful, Phil. Bless your heart.
And now we go to Sheila. Sheila gets what will amount to the last bunch of words.
I did mention my website earlier, writing like handwriting, it real, R-E-A-L, or you can just find me real easily at SheilaBender@gmail.com. I would like to say something I remember when we're talking about tears. I remember hearing a keynote speech by Annie Lamott, the writer, at Seattle University in one of their spiritual writing events. She said she cries. She was asked a question like that. And she said she cries buckets around her ankles every day, and everybody should. And I think it's true. We really, really should.
And those are not your last words, your last poem or your last words.
Okay, thank you. It's called Now, to Seth Bender on his birthday, October 1st, 2019. I read time now like a book, front to back or back to front, midsection first or by random pages. Changing it up spins your life longer somehow. And though I know the ending can never be rewritten, I savor who you were and who you will always be. Write catching ups and checking ins to create more love for me to feel in the only present possible. So in this season come round again, in the rush of fall wind and thickening clouds of winter, I can still imagine son and a wife and children paddling with you along the shores of Discovery Bay, gleaming wood of the kayaks visible as they move farther and farther from where I stand, holding them dear, even as I must let them go.
Sheila, a new theology was very hard for me. Part of the reason for that was actually my son, when he was a student at the University of Colorado, did ski on those same slopes. And you can imagine the thoughts that can go through my head as I'm reading about Seth. Your recent book, it was a sigh of relief for me. Let's put it that way. It just, a lot of tension was relieved, and I needed that tension to be relieved. And with that, I'm going to say thank you, Sheila. Thank you for the idea of
getting
together.
And I want to remind everybody that whatever accidents happen in life, most people don't die of them. I mean, I think we have to say that too. Most of us are here alive and needing to cope with loss, but we're not the ones who are gone yet.
Well, Sheila, thank you for the idea. Thank you for the email that started this off. And then the same to you, Joanne. And now I'm going to say goodbye to you both.
Bye. Thank you.